Welcome to the Big 60s Sort Out, brought to you by the Big Beatles Sort Out. We spent three series sorting the Beatles, and now we're turning our attention to the competition, context, the bigger picture. Who were they up against? What music influenced them? And will we hear the shockwaves of the Beatles' epic success as we saw all the UK number ones from the 1960s by ranking them for music, lyrics and production? Thanks for joining us as we try and sort out the 60s. Welcome to Series 4, Episode 6. I'm Gary Abbott, author, musician, podcaster, and please welcome my popular music history expert brother, Paul.
Hello, everyone. Hope you're all well. It's Burns night as we're recording this, so This week I have a whiskey beside me at the computer.
Oh, do you? Oh.
Yeah, I'm not deliberately doing a different spirit every week. It's just coincidence that I had some gin last week and I've got whiskey this week.
Oh.
But yes, merry Scotland, everyone. For a couple of weeks ago when you hear this. You all right, Gary?
I'm all right, thank you. I'm not too bad.
Good, okay. Well, I tell you what, before we get going, can I give some shout-outs to some of our friends?
You may.
Yes, so we've got a few little things here that I think is worth mentioning. People who are friends of the show or have supported us in the past, or people you might know from being online. People may know the RetroTube podcast, and they may know Adam Leslie, who's part of the team of that. The team, there's two of them. Adam is also an... is a team.
Technically.
Like we're a team.
Yeah.
Adam is also an author as well as a podcaster and a musician, and he's just had announced, as of the week we're recording this, that his book, his new book, is coming out on Dead Ink Books, which is a publisher in Liverpool, even though Adam's down in Oxford.
Yeah.
And it's a book called Lost in the Garden, which he describes as being a dreamlike literary folk horror about nostalgia, regret, and half-forgotten memories, which sounds very, very intriguing.
It does indeed.
And so you should all go and have a look for that and pre-order it. I think that's coming out in May. You should find that on just by searching for Lost in the Garden, Dead Ink, or searching for Adam on the usual stuff, or RetroTube, and we'll put links up for that as well. So that looks very exciting.
Yeah, it sounds.
And it does sound exciting. Mm. And another good friend of the show is our friend Peter Martin up here in Liverpool, and he has just restarted his entirely vinyl music-based podcast, which is called Hefty Tomatoes.
Right.
So it's under the name Old Rope, Hefty Tomatoes, and he does a podcast which is on Mixcloud.com, so you search for Hefty Tomatoes on there. And it's all vinyl stuff, really, really interesting selections, lots of really cool soul stuff particularly that he does. And he's just restarted that after quite a long break for almost a couple of years.
Is it like a mix, kind of like, is he doing a mix? Is he talking about the music? Or
he's doing a little bit of chat.
Yeah.
Doing a little bit of chat between, but it's really, really interesting selections he gets on there.
Right.
So look into Hefty Tomatoes on Mixcloud.com and you get good sort of half hour selections that are worth listening to.
Nice.
And as always, I'd like to shout out to Noisebox Radio, who have got such brilliant shows on there. A bunch of different DJs, but of course our friend Ben Baker does a handful of different shows on there. And we can really recommend looking into Noisebox Radio for, again, different types of people doing different types of things, so you get different types of music, which sounds great.
Yeah.
And is great. So
A good mixture of independent, established stuff, isn't it? Like
all sorts of things.
And cast his net wide, but with a keen eye or ear.
And
keen ear.
Ben is also a very silly man, and that is is an absolute advantage to his shows as well.
Yeah.
That is in no way a criticism. That is an absolute thumbs up because of the silliness.
Yeah.
So go and find Adam's book, Pete's podcast, and Ben's shows on Noisebox Radio. There's some stuff from me at the start.
There we go. And as always, you can keep in touch with us on Twitter and Instagram at @big_sort or email us at bigbeatlesortout@gmail.com and give us a like, give us a review, tell other people.
Yes, please.
We've got a lovely core of people. We just like it to, boom, just kind of go out a bit more. So please, if you can. And people do, so thank you very much. And, you know, look at the link. We always put the links. I always put the links to mine and Paul's respective kind of main music projects in there. A click and a listen, and even a purchase if you want. There's CDs and vinyls to be had. Go for it. Paul, so we're into 1961 now.
We are.
We did 1961 last week. We're into the kind of we're getting into spring 61, aren't we? Really. So, what's
spring
happening?
To sort of summer, I'd say, start of summer.
Yeah. So, what were the Beatles doing around now, Paul? As this section is called.
snappy yeah. title. So we ended at the sort of end of March in 1961, and this is going to take us through to the end of June 1961, and essentially we're back to Hamburg. So John and George,
going back again.
Yeah. They've come back at the end of 1960, done a few months at home, really, really blowing people away.
Yeah.
And now John and George are getting into Hamburg on the train this time, on the 30th of March 1961. Paul and Pete follow a day later, a day or two later.
Hmm.
So they're not in a van, you know, cramped up together on a really, really long drive. They're travelling by train this time. But they're playing at the Top 10 Club. Right. Under a guy called Peter Eckhorn, and like the schedule's even, you know, there's even more playing than before, but it's a better club. You know, this is a club that they're still talking about in the Get Back film, where they're like, oh, do you remember the sound of the echo unit they had there? That was the best we ever had. Hmm. Which is mad, really, to think, you know, that 8 years later, they couldn't imagine it being better than their second time in Hamburg. But they're playing at 7 p.m. to 2 a.m. on weekdays, 8 p.m. to 4 a.m. on the weekends for six nights a week.
8 p.m.
And they only get like 15 minutes off each hour.
Yeah. Gosh.
So that's just a nutcase amount of just bonkers.
Like people would do that for charity now, wouldn't they? That's like a you'd get sponsored to do a kind of 8 hour straight gig set, wouldn't you?
Yeah. But one thing that is helping is they play with Tony Sheridan a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So they're either backing him up when he does some slots or he's playing with them. So it sort of breaks it up a little bit for them. But it's still a mad amount of
I imagine they also did things like want that maybe could they cover for each other if one of them wanted a bit longer off, and they could do some maybe do some solo stuff or duet-y stuff. Did they do that? Do you know?
Well, they did all sorts of different combinations of things, definitely. But it's mainly them on stage because that's what they're contracted to do as a group of people. So apart from Stuart, who is obviously off living with Astrid's family, they're staying in a room above the club, so which is a not great, but still a step up from the back of the Bambino, you know. But it's that, you know, there's so much work. This is the time they really get into Preludin, the pep pills.
Oh, yeah.
It's also a time when they write to Alan Williams, who'd sort of organised all this stuff, and basically say, we're not sending you your cut. We're severing our ties. And he's basically threatening to get them banned from the circuit back home.
Right.
So they had to make a decision. They were like, well, why are we sending him money? We're here now, which is, you know, a bit of a crappy thing to do, but, you know, it's all part of the cockiness of youth, I suppose.
Hmm.
They're also sort of, Pete's drifting off because he goes off and does his own thing. He's got a girlfriend in Germany as well, you know. So he's not hanging around with them as much. So there's that sort of emotional split.
Yeah.
And also they kind of know...
He's not part of the core... He's drifting away from the core unit.
Yeah. But yeah, there's also that thing that they know Stu is essentially going to give up playing bass soon because he's going to art college. So it's very hard to dedicate yourself to your career as an artist and also do those hours that I've mentioned before.
Yeah.
So everyone's sort of looking at each other like, who's going to be the bass player? But of course, we know it's going to end up being Paul.
Yeah.
Because I think the problem is he's just so good at everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, he can play the bass without it being restrung upside down.
Yeah.
To suit his left-handedness and things like that. It's nuts. It's all nuts. But, you know, Paul ends up on bass. And rather than buy Stu's bass or buy a bass or someone else, he goes off to a shop to get a proper Hofner violin bass. Because Hofner's a German brand, and it wasn't difficult to order a left-handed one, so he could have a proper one instead of having to just faff around with an upside-down normal one. Normal, that's terrible, isn't it? Right-handed people are normal.
Oh, dear.
Not that. It just means that he could, because he's in the country of origin, it was easy to get hold of a left-handed Hofner violin bass.
I just think when he went in there and said, can I have a left-handed violin bass, I bet the person there didn't think, I'm probably making one of the most important sales for this company.
Of all time, of ever.
Because you know, people are going to carry on buying this. It was probably just, I'm sure people like them because they are lovely looking things, but it's so hard to know.
There was another group was using one as well, and so he would have seen someone using one in some of the clubs. But yeah, you're right. Someone sold him the most important instrument, you know, that they would ever sell for Hofner. But this is also the point where a producer by the name of Bert Kampfert sees them and starts making arrangements for them to back Tony Sheridan.
Yes.
Okay, so on the 22nd of June, 1961, the Beatles, in their version as Paul on bass, even though Stu's with them for the day, just to be there, go and do this recording session with Tony Sheridan and Bert Kampfert and make this record where they do Ain't She Sweet and Beatle Bop, which is what we know as Cry for a Shadow now. Mm-hmm. If anyone wants to hear more about this, of course, I appeared on I Am the Egg Pod talking about the album The Beatles First.
Yes.
So you can look that up and there's lots more detail about that there.
And it's, it's always good to give the Egg Pod a little shout out as well because it's just a little podcast, isn't it?
He needs a leg up from us. He needs a leg up for the likes of us. I very much enjoyed doing that episode and digging into these sorts of things. But yeah, without going into tons of stuff about what happened in this bit of Hamburg, because there's plenty of books to go and read about that. Their final day at the Top Ten Club was the 1st of July. So after that, Stu and Astrid are staying behind and the four-piece Beatles are going back to Liverpool. And that's where we leave it now.
Da-da, theme music. Whatever it would be for the episode. Depends if they had the rights to actually use the Beatles music. You know, the worst thing in the world would be is if they did make that Netflix special that I'm always talking about, but they didn't get the rights to the music. It would be like...
Look, it hasn't stopped biopic producers before. I'll tell you that much. It's one of the weirdest things, the legalities of making a biopic. Not just the legalities of using someone's image and name and stuff like that, especially if they're still alive. But the legalities of the music publishing industry and all that sort of stuff is just... you get some insane... is it Michael Jackson, Man in the Mirror?
Right.
Which, I mean, I do not recommend anyone to watch that. I watched it as part of me doing my MA about it. But it's like every time it gets to the point where there's about to be some music or he's going on stage, they have a little bit of like library music or specially composed stuff and then cut away. And it's because they can't show anything.
It's the same, right? You can just tune into Sky Arts at any time and find a Beatles documentary where there's just generic 60s twangy music. But anyway, we're not going to take you off on a biopics rabbit hole. But we can keep up the German link though, can't we, Paul?
We certainly can.
Yes, because first up we have Elvis Presley, Wooden Heart.
And if you say goodbye, then I know that I would cry. Maybe I would die, cause I don't have a wooden heart. There's no strings upon this love of mine, it was always you from the start.
Wooden Heart, Paul?
No, meat. Meat, my heart is made of meat. I started saying that, I thought, what is a heart made of?
My heart is made of meat. My heart is made of meat.
Because I do have a meat heart. Right. Oh, it's Elvis with another song adapted from something else. Get used to hearing that for a bit.
Yeah.
Okay. Gets to number one on the 23rd of March, 1961. It spends 6 weeks at number one and is the biggest seller of the year.
What?
6 weeks Wooden Heart spends at number one.
Oh, my God.
Not at number one. No, at number one.
Exactly.
And much, much long. Sorry, I'm getting so confused. It spends much longer in the charts. 6 weeks at number one. Biggest seller of the year.
Unbelievable. What was going on with people? What did they want? If it's not death discs, it's Disney German music.
So it's out on RCA, but it's produced as part of the soundtrack to the film G.I. Blues.
Mm-hmm.
So the producer, nominally, I think, is Stephen Scholes, but actually the music supervisor for Paramount is Joseph Lilly with the engineer Al Schmidt. But I think you can just assume it's a usual team in RCA Studios. Mm. I mean, obviously this is an import because it's an American record, but it was never a single or not an A-side of a single in America.
Right.
Which is nuts that it can be a huge worldwide number one without being number one in America.
Give it to the Brits. They'll eat this stuff up. You know,
the Europeans certainly will as well.
Yeah. Well, the Europeans obviously we are European. We were.
Weren't then. We weren't in the common market then, you see. No.
But you'd have thought it was, I don't know. Go on.
Anyway, its composers are listed as Fred Wise and Ben Weissman, Kate Womey and Bert Kampfert.
Oh.
So there's that name I've already mentioned once. So it's me talking about the Beatles meeting Bert Kampfert at a time when Bert Kampfert's name is on a record.
With the Elvis.
That is,
yeah, of course, because this,
yeah,
this is happening at the same time. Oh.
So that's what always a thing to remember is when people say, oh, they did that record in Germany with, you know, on Polydor with Bert Kampfert. This is Bert Kampfert. He was massive. He was a huge, famous producer. He'd had hits himself with his orchestra.
Right.
So, you know, they must have been like, oh, right, blimey.
They could have been in the room with Bert Kampfert kind of discussing what they're going to do. And while the radio goes on, he could be going, this could have come on the radio, and he could have gone, I did this. This was me.
What am I, this?
This is what am I.
Yeah, I mean, for all we know, he might have heard them playing Wooden Heart in the club, because they did play it.
Right.
Which is, again, quite mad.
Yeah, what?
Let's get the Beatles link out the way. Obviously, Bert Kampfert is part of the... He arranges this version of Wooden Heart, of the song that becomes Wooden Heart.
Mm.
It's... So he takes a folk song, he makes an arrangement of it, and then the others do the Americanizing of the lyrics, etc.
Okay.
An arrangement for, you know, as a pop record. But yeah, the Beatles, so Chas Newby, who I mentioned as like fill-in bass player for a little while, remembered them having to learn, well, him having to learn Wooden Heart while he was with them at the sort of end of 1960, start of 1961.
Okay.
So the Beatles learned it in Germany before it came out in the UK.
Ah, right.
And because it's got German words in it, it obviously went down a storm.
Yeah.
You know. But apparently they played it in their set for a while in the UK as well, including the Valentine's Day dance, where Paul was wearing around his neck a wooden heart with their names written on it, the Beatles' names on it.
Mm.
And it was raffled off. And part of the thing was, obviously, you win the wooden heart, but you also win a kiss from Paul.
Oh.
Which causes a stampede, basically, and knocks everyone on their arses. You know, it's so nuts to think that that is how popular they were.
Yeah.
That at that time, as an unsigned band. It's really mad.
Hmm.
But it's such a weird one to imagine them playing. Because bomb type thing. Yeah, it's an adaptation of a European tune, which is essentially called Must I Then, written by a chap called Friedrich Silcher and published in 1827. So it's another really well-known tune in Germany. And of course, Elvis has been in Germany in the army, and this has helped to inspire this film G.I. Blues, which comes out in the UK at the end of December, or partway through December. And yeah, it's really interesting. I'll tell you what, I was doing some research about this in this big two-volume book of Elvis biography type thing that I've got.
Yeah.
It's not even got an entry in there, Wooden Heart, because it wasn't a hit in America.
Oh, I see.
It's just a track on the G.I. Blues soundtrack album.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
and in fact,
very strange.
Another singer called a guy called Joe Dowell covered it and had a hit in America with it.
Right.
So Elvis didn't have a hit with it in America, which is really interesting. They're really managing to target this overseas market.
Well, yeah, obviously, like I say, they're releasing it in the UK. They must have decided that we just lumped us all in together, you know.
Yeah, it'd obviously been out in Germany. It was also a hit in all the sort of surrounding countries.
Yeah.
And then, comes to the UK as well and is a hit there. So they were doing something right with that tuba and accordion.
Well, let's have a talk about the music then and see what it is then. But first, I must declare an interest, Paul, because...
Go on.
I do know this song really, really well.
I know this song really well.
But mainly,
I wonder if it's for the same reason.
Mainly from the Complete Piano Player Volume 1 songbook. Is it the Complete...
Is it Piano Player or Keyboard Player?
I
can't remember.
It's one of the
two. We had both.
Yeah,
I think it was Complete Keyboard Player.
Was it the song on the last page with the one, of the, or was it just one of the songs
I
in
don't
there?
Know. I think it's just one of the songs.
This is one of the songs that was part of our formative kind of
learning
musical
how to play
education.
Keyboard instruments.
Yeah. And I think the version I played badly as a 10-year-old was I probably like it better than this, to be honest.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Oh, controversy. I've never listened to it. before. Never. I knew it existed, and I kind of knew that Elvis did. I think I've heard that Elvis had done it. I was like, Elvis did that song that goes do 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 do, and I knew it had a Bavarian heritage of some kind, but I just didn't realise it was full on Elvis singing along to kind of an umpire-y accordion thing. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Like, and that's it. It's like, right, okay. I kind of thought that the jauntiness was just because it had been converted to a learn to play piano book, not because that is actually what the song's like. I mean, given the hell they gave Dylan when he plugged in and stopped playing folk music, what did Elvis fans do when this stuff came out? They
bought it.
They just
That's
bought
what happened.
It. Why didn't they?
And they bought it in their droves.
Yeah. What about the people who are like into Hound Dog and like that kind of stuff and the rock and roll? They must have been.
Well, yeah. I mean, they turned a lot of people off, but he also turned a lot of people on because he was now safer and a bit more family friendly. So you've just in many ways widened your audience.
Yeah, he went.
Although I am starting to go mad by the amount of Elvis. Elvis does adaptation of
yes, yeah.
European thing.
It's a winning formula at the time, isn't it?
It's no Heartbreak Hotel anymore, is
no.
it? You know, it's.
It's just, yes. Anyway, I mean, the thing is with the other ones so far, though, they've been these big ballads and these big kind of croonery things. This is just a funny little. I mean, it's catchy. I'm not going to say it's not.
It's only 2 minutes
yeah.
long or something.
It's just a little catchy kind of stage song, or as we now know from the movie, a scene song. I mean, I put down, I could imagine this in a Disney film, but it doesn't need to be imagined in a Disney film. It was in an actual film, you know, where he's dancing with some wooden puppets, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically, I think it's a scene in G.I. Blues, which I've never seen all the way through, where he's at some, like, puppet show thing and the guy's wind-up gramophone's broken or the record's broken
yeah.
or something. And he's like, what song do you do? And he's like, duh, duh, duh. Oh, I know that one. Let's give it a go. And then goes and sings and kisses a little wooden puppet.
Yeah.
And it's weird.
It is. But, I mean, it would be absolutely fine and lovely in the corner of some beer keller somewhere. And you go, oh, there's a nice little traditional band playing something. And there's always a guy singing. But 6 weeks at number one. I can't reconcile the two things. I don't really know what to say about it musically. It's a tune from a kid's learn to play piano book in my mind, and it still sounds like that, but on an umpire type of brass thing and an accordion and the little song being sang. It's perfectly fine, but I don't see why. I think they just were built. I think Elvis could have trumped into a microphone, Paul, and I think he would have got a number one. 36 for music for this one, I've given it.
Interesting. I think the point is, though, it's a folk tune. It's a well-known tune, particularly in Germany. It's very easily singable.
Yeah, yes.
Once you've heard it once,
yeah.
you know it.
Well,
you know,
keep that in mind when we get later down, and I'll call back to that.
I just want to mention, of course, the accordion on this is played by someone called Jimmy Haskell, and the accordion's the main musical feature.
Yeah,
I'd say, except for the tuba, which is played by Ray Siegel, and there's a lovely sort of mandolin guitar thing going along with it, played by Hilmer J. Tiny Timbrell.
Tiny Tim. Was there a Tiny Tim in there?
Tiny Tim. No, Tiny. Yeah. Can't you see I love you? Tiny Tim impression for you there, folks. Sorry I didn't warn you. Yeah, that's always a great nickname, Tiny Timbrell. I don't know if Tiny Timbrell was actually 6'6".
Right.
But
okay.
There you go.
Very confused. Production. So I've hardly got any notes on this, but I do need to say one big note, and I checked two different versions of this to make sure I wasn't imagining it. But is it me, or is there actual just complete distorted peaking out on his vocal in some of the versions?
I had to look for a couple of different masters. There was one version where I was like, oh, this is a bit.
I listened to two, the main one being on the main streamer, you know, on Spotify, and another one being on a YouTube video. And they both had the crackly when he starts singing loud. And then, but then the YouTube video you sent me from the film, which I imagine will be a different dub of it and everything, won't it? I presume it's not just the same dub version.
I don't know.
That one was fine. But on the commercially available Elvis One album type of digital track that's out there, it's got crackling and all, which would make me...
I don't like those mixes on Elvis One.
No.
I think they're a bit much. So if you want some technical details, this is take four. So they do four takes of this in the studio, one complete one, a couple of false starts, and then one more complete one, which becomes the master. So it's not like they've spent ages doing it.
No.
It's just, it's amazing how quickly they turn some of these things out that become hits, really.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did find, I was listening to one version, I thought, this does sound terrible. But I think part of the problem as well, especially with streamers and people like Elvis, it doesn't seem to happen with the Beatles because their stuff seems much more controlled. There's been so many versions and releases over the years and remasters and remixes of and packages of stuff that a lot of crappy mixes and remasters end up on there. So you do get ones where it's like the voice is distorted. But if you get a good one, it's different. It just amazes me that it can happen that way.
It's not like he's one of the obscure artists who you think, well, no one's looking after his legacy. I mean, it's Elvis, isn't it? So... I'm marking him down for
But yes, I agree. I did hear a version where it was really breaking up on the mic.
But other than that, the band, the players are just relentlessly playing in the background. There's no rise or fall or anything to it. And then he's singing over the top. And it's in the versions I heard, singing too hot as far as the microphone's concerned. So I've given it 33 for production and I have nothing else to say about it.
Okay, fair enough.
So lyrics...
I've just said... Basically, it doesn't inspire me particularly, but there's nothing wrong with it.
It would be fine. It's just because we're talking about it in relation to it being the biggest selling song of 1961 in the UK. It's strange. I didn't know it would be. I wasn't expecting it to be in here. I knew that Elvis had done Wooden Heart, and I thought it was from a film or something. I didn't know it had been a big hit. It's strange.
Just have to remember that for everyone saying, "Oh, he was never the same after he came out of the army." Yeah. True, he wasn't the same. He was more successful in many respects.
Absolutely, yeah.
For a little while, at least. And not just more successful a bit. Like, pre-order success mania gold disc craziness.
Yeah. It's crazy.
On to lyrics.
So what confuses me about this, like I mentioned about it sounding like a Disney film and, thinking about Bavarian things to do with wood... Disney, wooden, German stuff. Where are you going? You know what I'm saying, don't you? Dumbo.
The Little Mermaid.
We both did the same joke with different punchlines. No, Pinocchio, right? And this song has the mention of having no strings upon this love of mine. And then you're in the realm of wooden puppets again, which makes sense now I've seen the video. So the words have been written specifically for that scene of the film for him to sing along in along with some puppets. They're not the traditional
words.
Yeah,
I think so. I don't know. I mean, I couldn't dig into this. This two-volume book...
doesn't have anything in
it. It's very, very detailed about almost everything, but has next to nothing about the G.I. Blues soundtrack and nothing about this song at all.
It's because he's insisting that he doesn't have a wooden heart, but we're never really told why we think he should. So, is Elvis a puppet, Paul? But with a human heart? Is Elvis a wooden puppet?
Of Colonel Tom Parker.
Yeah.
But is that Colonel Tom over there? Is he coming over?
Oh, here he comes.
No, I'm not doing him again.
No, but he's not a puppet with a human heart, is he? That doesn't... No.
A meat heart, I think.
A meat heart.
As the doctors call it.
A heart of meat. I haven't bothered translating the German bit. I'm going to have a wild guess that it's just a repeat, but in German, how's your German, Paul? Better than mine, I imagine.
Better than yours, but not very good. Muss I denn, zum Stadteller hinaus... Stadteller hinaus und du mein Schatz bleibst hier. Oh, I'm sorry to our German listeners.
Yes,
German, German
Dieter
speakers.
Can probably...
Yeah.
It's the same. I think that's the... Can't you see?
But that's the magic for them in terms of selling it in Europe and particularly Germany. It's having another language in there. And I think it's sort of this sort of thing that quite a few record companies go, oh, that happened with that song.
Let's get the beat.
We got a lot of big sales on continental Europe. Let's, if you're going to have a hit here, it needs to have the original language. Yeah. That's why you end up with the Beatles.
Having
to do some of their early stuff.
Yeah. Anyway, I always thought you had a heart of stone if you were meant to be cold or dead hearted. Not wood, but anyway, it still works. It's just strange. 39 for lyrics, 36 overall. There we go. Shall we move on?
Let's move on.
Next we have... The Marcells, Blue Moon. Blue moon. Blue Moon, Paul?
I don't know. I've got the curtains closed. It was a full moon yesterday, so it's a waning moon today, 99% probably. I don't know.
It's not as catchy a lyric, is it?
No, it's not as catchy as bomb, 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 danga, dang, dang. Yeah. Blue Moon by the Marcells becomes number one on the 4th of May after the towering reign of Wooden Heart. Yeah. Spends 2 weeks at number one. Produced by Stu Phillips and Danny Winchell. It's composed by Richard Rodgers and Lorenzo Hart. So another feature we're seeing a lot of here is a very old song.
Yes.
Being used to become a hit in the 60s.
Yeah, being reworked, yeah.
Yeah, the B-side of this is Goodbye to Love, which is a bit of a sort of just a very okay ballad. But Pye put this record out because they see that it's a hit in America, where it was. Obviously, Blue Moon's been done, not in this version necessarily, by loads of people, including Elvis.
Yeah.
Because it's an old sort of great American songbook standard, really. And then the Marcells come along, this doo-wop group, and just stick this extra bit of another song that they do on top of it, like the front bit of it, the bomb-ba-bomb stuff.
Yeah.
And turn it into this brilliant hit, which seems to have gone down well enough to become number one, but also really annoyed loads of people who think it's just gibberish.
Right, okay. Oh,
and you know what? Good. It's brilliant, though. Yeah. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
No. Yeah, so the Marcells were... Cornelius Harp was the lead singer, so like the high parts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Fred Johnson on bass. Gene Bricker and Ron Mundy were tenors, and Richard Nouse was the baritone. We could go into the career of them, but they're a sort of group that apparently was always breaking up and reforming and breaking up. And after this, some of them left and some new people came in, and then occasionally they reform and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And like quite a lot of vocal groups, they have this sort of rolling, ongoing career in one form or another. And this is their only hit in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly their only number one. But if we want a Beatles link.
Okay, go on.
Apparently, the promotional version of this, or the demo possibly even, ends up in the hands of Murray the K, the DJ who was sort of,
I know, yeah.
Who was
evangelized
such a big part
the Beatles kind of takeover.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was the guy who really pushed it on his show. Apparently did one of those stunts where he played it like 26 times on one show, which is great. And we also know that certainly John and Paul loved the Elvis version of this song anyway.
Yeah.
So what they thought of the Marcells version, I don't know that I've ever seen any reference to that, but it'd be interesting to find out, I think.
But I mean, it would probably have been kind of inaccessible to them because it's such a technical jobby, this, isn't it? That being a close harmony. I mean, obviously the Beatles were a close harmony group, but not in this sense. Not in the actual,
no, very different
not in the
of
kind
vocal,
of like
vocal thing.
Almost being an a cappella group doing the parts and everything, the bass part. But I do love a close harmony group, Paul, as you can probably imagine. I especially love one that has a man on the bass vocal so prominent you can't really concentrate on the lead. Which is
I think that's something that comes into production
of the song. But apart from that, it's a great little song. Hooky and fun, sang amazingly by all the singers.
Yeah.
And with a great melody, which is obviously borrowing that magic from its, you know, from its previous versions, but it's a good melody to choose to zuzz up in this way. And making that feature of the that bass, that vocal bass riff, is great. Which is kind of very unique up to this point, really. I think we've heard a bit of that kind of bass backing vocals in the songs. But we've not had a lot. We've had a little bit in Tell Laura I Love Her. There was a bit of bum, 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 bum in a very inappropriate place.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's it so far. I take it it's more of a throwback to 50s, really, isn't it? That kind of sound.
Well, there's certainly a group that comes out of that 50s doo-wop scene.
Yeah.
a lot of which I really, really love. Mm. But there's not really been anything this intense.
No.
in the British charts, I don't think, where not only is it the, you know, like you say, you've hit the nail on the head. It's got lovely chords and a lovely melody by virtue of the song that it is.
Yeah.
Rodgers and Hart, brilliant writers. But they've just stuck all this madness on it, and nothing else has that sort of energy that we've come across at all. And I don't really think we have anything again that's particularly like this, but we shall see.
It stands on its own, doesn't it? I like how, along with the great pacey fun vocals and everything, we've got electric bass just kind of keeping the stepping rhythm between chords, giving that, you know, that stepping kind of bass, passing notes, and the guitar and the drums are just working with it to punctuate the singing. It's all in service of the singing. There's a bit of a wobble in the middle section where the bass vocal stays on a note, but the electric bass moves between the two root notes, and something doesn't always sound quite right. Like the bass vocal should move too, but it doesn't.
I think there is a couple of fluffs in there.
Yeah, and it comes. It's only in
there certainly is on the B side. There's a couple of points where the tuning goes out.
Yeah.
But apparently this is a two take wonder. This.
Well, it survives on pure energy alone. I think that bit's kind of like, is that going out? Oh, it's gone. We're back into the bit. It's just kind of brings you along.
You don't need to be looking at it with a microscope, really, do you?
Not at all. I've given it 58 for music. I enjoyed this.
Yeah, I think it's a winner. So they've taken this, they covered a song called Zoom by a band called the Cadillacs. And they've taken from their version of that cover, the Bomba Bomb stuff, and stuck it onto this 1934 song by Rodgers and Hart, which was very well known because the tune for it was used for a film and then used for another film with new lyrics and then eventually became a commercial release in 34. So it's a very well-known song. And that's what I think particularly why people got really, really annoyed with it. So like Disc magazine, 18th of March, 1961. The title is Pie Rush Hit, a record by an unknown American group which has just jumped to 15th position within 2 weeks of release, is to be rush released in Britain by Pie International on March 22. The disc is a swinging, beaty and controversial arrangement of the standard Blue Moon by a group called the Marcells. So, you know, one of its first mentions in the British press is saying it's controversial.
Controversial. It's the way they're doing all them bong, bonga, bing, bing. What's the word? What do they sing?
Bomba.
Bomb. I can't think what the actual word is.
It's lots of bombs and dangs and dings and dongs.
Yeah. I just people obviously huruffing around. Oh, have you heard it? It's all bombs and dingy dongs.
You've just said huruffing as well.
I know, huruffing. Yeah, it's good. It makes as much sense as most of the last 30 seconds. Let's go into production then. So I went and listened to two versions of this one as well because I don't think the stereo mix that I got on Spotify helped, because the bass vocal was distractingly loud and the mono...
The stereo version has all the instruments off to one side, which does give the voices more space, but you are right, the backing vocals are very dominant over the lead.
And so I found a mono mix, I think, on YouTube that didn't completely solve it, but it's better because it's all a bit more kind of flattened out. It sounded better altogether than having that one loud voice kind of separated and dominating, like there's a man standing in your right ear just singing the bass parts louder than everyone else. But it's just generally it's great. There's just some balancing needed on that mix, and it feels very fixable. And I bet there's versions out there where they've done that. Because when the bass voice isn't having a feature, it needs to be brought back in line with the rest. But it still seems to be, because it obviously is a feature, but then it seems to stay the same volume even though it's now just part of the group. And that makes the lead singer feel secondary in places, which is wrong because it's an absolutely great vocal and that should be getting as much emphasis.
There's a lovely sort of like vocal solo, you know, a wordless solo towards the end, which is really nice.
It is. There's some amazing stuff going on in all of the parts. It's just why the balance could have been a little bit better. But that said, having all those voices leading a song like this with the band really just there supporting it, I think makes for a really great record. Like that. The whole concept of this does sound good, and is captured well, generally, apart from that mixing. So I've given it 48 for production.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So on to lyrics then. So, I mean, these lyrics are obviously traditional.
Well, yeah, the main ones.
The main ones, apart from the ones that we can't pronounce, being dim, ding,
dip, 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 moon, moon, blue moon.
But yeah, I mean, so the moon saw him all sad and lonely, and then they sent him a woman, I think.
He said, by the power of the moon.
Yeah, and then the moon turned golden. Is that what happens next? And then
it does.
Yeah, yeah. You knew just what I was there for. You heard me saying a prayer for someone I could really care for. And then there suddenly appeared before me, the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, please adore me. And then I looked and the moon had turned gold. It's actually a bit of a trip, this song. A moon makes a woman and turns gold, basically. It's a bit strange. But the whole blue...
The moon went red and all the monsters came back like in Zelda.
Yeah. Annoyingly as well. I mean, it is annoying when that happens. But the whole blue moon theme and the first verse alone is classic. Those words are classic. So I've given it... But they're all right. 44 for lyrics, 50 overall.
Let me just tell you a little bit more about the reception of it. So Patrick Doncaster, who was like the disc reviewer in the Daily Mirror, who I think I've mentioned a couple of times before, or certainly read out things he's written. So 30th of March 1961, a success from America comes our way, and I could do without it. The lovely melodic Blue Moon gets a real going over by a vocal group called the Marcells. It begins with some stuttering gibberish, and then in bold it says, someone might be able to understand it, in outer space, or somewhere. Misery. And then there's another bit from the Daily Mirror, which I think is Patrick Doncaster again, headed, Oh, Those Marcells. And this is from August of 61. And he says, must we have more of the Marcells, the American vocal group that murdered Blue Moon into the number one spot last May? And he says, here they come again on Pi International with You Are My Sunshine. It's about as sunny as a Saturday night in Dartmoor in December. And it wasn't a hit anyway, well, so certainly not as big as that.
Well, he's going to be right if he just assassinates songs often enough, he'll get one that isn't a hit. But to say something murdered a song into number one...
Murdered its way into number one.
I love the way that they've absolutely butchered this song and ruined it. I'm going to go and buy it. Yeah, weird. Okay, so yeah, 44 for lyrics, 50 overall. So we move on, Paul.
Uh-huh.
Next we have Floyd Kramer on the rebound. On the rebound, Paul?
No, thank you. I'm happily settled. Everything's all right, Tar.
Okay.
Well. Oh, God, it's so tedious doing those things. I'm so sorry, everyone. Floyd Kramer, anyway, a name we've mentioned a lot so far as part of the Nashville A team playing on all these records, especially lots of the Elvis stuff.
Oh, cool.
So his name's come up a lot. This gets to number one on the 18th of May, 61. So he spends 1 week at number one, which is criminal.
Yes.
When Wooden Heart was was there for six. So, funnily enough, this is produced by Chet Atkins at the RCA Studios, engineered by good old Bill Porter.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Floyd Kramer original. The flip side is a cover of the song Mood Indigo, instrumental cover. Like I say, we've mentioned Floyd Kramer a lot because he plays on so many of those songs and albums that we've talked about, the singles.
Yeah.
He's always mentioned as being famous for this thing called the slip note playing style, which is essentially where you, on the piano, you just sort of slide up, you sort of go onto the third of a scale by sliding up from the note just below it type thing.
Yes, yeah, that,
not literally sliding.
I know exactly what you mean, but yeah, I know what you mean.
I don't have a piano keyboard instrument.
It's basically what he's doing all the way through the hook of this song.
Yeah, this whole song is that style.
It's basically like Lady Madonna, isn't it? He does it in Lady Madonna.
It's got a bit of that sort of stride style, yeah.
No, but he does the slide, bit on the right hand.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And on For You Blue as well. McCartney does that sort of thing. But if you want a Beatles link, or, you know, beyond his inspiration influence through Elvis, yeah, and he also played the piano on the song Anna, which the Beatles cover.
Yeah.
He plays on Walking in the Park with Eloise, which is the Paul McCartney production of the song that his dad wrote. You know, that they released as the Country Hams. Yeah,
we did it on series sort of, 3, didn't we?
Yeah.
Or 2.
So, yeah, Floyd 3. Kramer's on a McCartney production, even if it's Jim McCartney rather than Paul.
So there we go.
So there you go. That's a good link, isn't it?
Mm. So, yeah,
and
go on.
Do you know what? It's great. Yeah. I just love it.
Well, this is one of those joys that I'm getting so many of in this series, which is something I've never heard before, which is always a plus, even if I don't like it. It's always nice to have heard something so I can make that decision. And not only did I have never heard it before, I wish I had, because it's great. And it's our second.
Gary, if this doesn't get to number one in the chart of your rankings, I'm going to flip this desk over.
Well, you can if you want. It's your desk.
Oh, no. I'm going to come down there and flip your desk over.
Yeah, you try it. No, I really like it. The piano phrase is great. I want to learn it badly, because that's the only way I could learn it. You know,
I was trying to find the like the score transcription of it, and I played the piano for a very, very long time.
Yeah, you're much better.
And I'm pretty good at it, except I don't practice enough. And I looked at this, and it's like, oh, hang on, no.
It's one of those ones that you wouldn't write. If you write it down, it'll look insane. It's something I think you'd have to figure out, wouldn't you? And just the more the shapes and the
I couldn't find
a
transcription
hands.
That I thought really reflected the subtleties.
But, so what is this style? It's kind of boogie-woogie-ish and kind of got some
It's
rockies.
A funny one, really, because he's essentially a country piano player at this point. Mm. You know, but he's doing all this stuff in the sort of Nashville pop scene. And he's moved from that into what, I mean, people are describing it as rock and roll, but it's not quite as simple as that.
It has some rocky sections.
It's more on the boogie side of rock.
Boogie and jazzy bit, but with then it settles into a bit of rockiness. It kind of uses rocky motifs and 60s motifs. Just that, like, there's just some strange little 60s, I don't know how to describe them. There's little kind of adornments you get in the strings now and again in some 60s. We had it in Only the Lonely as well, just the strings do some, you know.
Well, I mean, same studio, probably the same players.
Yeah, that kind of thing. But, I mean, for me, this is a song that's got to number one because someone sat down, well, this guy sat down, he's bashed out a funky piano phrase and thought, that's it. let's not turn it into a song or give it to anyone. Let's just jam this out. Make sure we get back to that. That's catchy. It's fun. It's funky, and it's rocking without a G, Paul. It's rocking.
Oh heck, blimey.
And I really wasn't expecting that. And I'm proud of the people of 1961 for getting this to number one for a couple of weeks. I'm starting to restore my faith in them a little bit.
One week, unfortunately.
Oh, 1 week, and the last one as well. But yeah, I like that there also seems to be guitars and bass doing stuff around the piano, so it's quite riff driven, and the bass line sounding, but it's kind of bouncing off the part. Their voices giving it a sustained backing along. There's no words in it; it's an instrumental, but there are backing vocals that kind of go along with the strings to give it a bit more of a bit more texture. Although they're perhaps a little shrill. But the bass gets a feature along with a really badly recorded drum solo, which we'll talk about. But the bassist is having lots of fun. If you listen, the bassist is really going for it. Yeah, and again, production note on that to talk about. But it's, music-wise, it got me dancing around and doing the chicken, Paul.
Oh, blimey.
So 61 for music I've given it.
I just think it's so insanely catchy.
Yeah.
It's like, can you imagine if you lived a life... It's like, this is my dream, is that you wake up in the morning and you throw back the covers and this is what your life feels like. This piece of music is what you're just like, that's how you go through your day.
Yeah.
Oh, it'd just be, imagine feeling that good.
Yeah, between this and Walk Right Back's theme without the words from last week, you've got two feel-good kind of sounding riffs to be walking down the street and winking and waving at people. With a big smile on your face, and you're kind of doing a strut as you're doing it.
Yeah, but not being smug about it.
No, you're
smug.
Happy.
This is genuine joy.
You're kind of like you're kind of doing the double finger point at people and spinning around and doing a big, you know, you just...
I'm not doing that, everyone.
You're twirling around a lamppost, you're jumping over a poodle, you're having fun.
What?
So, isn't that how everyone has fun? So, production though, unfortunately, production's going to let it down a bit here, Paul. So, this is going to have trouble getting to number one. The piano's great, and the focus has gone on that. And the vocals sit all right in there, but the bass is too low and weedy. The bass isn't proper bassy. It could be better. It works well in places when it kind of blends into the piano stride bass, but when the bass features, it's all weedy and thin. And then the drum solo, which is just... just really badly recorded. It's like...
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a deliberate heaviness, a deliberate sort of driving of this. So I... because that's the section with this sort of the hand clap section, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's like it suddenly becomes a feature that's just like, oh yeah. I like it, I feel. And then it's got the beow, beow string bits after that.
Oh, dear.
I like the energy.
I think it sounds distorted and...
oh, man, you're going to let me down.
Oh, yeah, sorry. And I think the strings are a little bit too too shrill and stealing the focus in places. They're in that register. Mm. They always like go an octave too high in some songs with strings for me. A little bit like making me twitch whilst I'm listening to them. So I love the song. And I just think there's bits of it that let it down production-wise. And I'm afraid I've given it 38 for production. Which, because
this... oh man, this desk was made for flipping.
Flip your own desk, Paul. I don't care. we're not even in the same room. We're not even in the same city. But it gives it 49.5 overall because there's no lyrics to score. And in this series, I'm just averaging the two. So respectable. But that's that.
Okay, let's move on to something completely different.
It's a very diverse 1961 at the moment, because next we have the Temperance Seven, You're Driving Me Crazy.
You're driving me crazy. What did I do? Oh, what did I do? My tears for you make everything easy. Clouding a sky of blue. How true were the friends who were near me to cheer me, believe me, they knew that you were the kind...
You're driving me crazy, Paul.
You're driving me crazy, Gary, with your flipping numbers.
Of course. Well.
Right. Hey, guess what?
What?
The producer of this record was George Martin.
Oh, okay. Oh, gosh. No.
Our first appearance of George Martin in the... series, not our last, funnily enough, but we're not going to hear much more of him attached to this sort of music after this point.
Okay.
Really? So You're Driving Me Crazy gets to number one on the 25th of May 1961.
Yeah.
It only spends 1 week at the top. It's written by Walter Donaldson. B-side is a number called Charlie My Boy, an instrumental. It's out on Parlophone, obviously, that George Martin was chief of. It's another old... tune. Various people cover this from 1930 onwards. Yeah. Yeah, and the Temperance Seven are essentially a art school trad jazz sort of comedy ensemble, the type of thing that gives rise eventually to like the Bonzos.
Yeah.
The Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, who are one of my absolute all-time favourite things ever. They're built out of this world of going and looking for sheet music and 78 RPM records of sort of 20s and 30s trad jazz and comedy numbers and things like that. Mm. They're called the Temperance Seven, but there's nine of them. The joke being that they're one over the eight, which is a phrase meaning drunk. Yeah. They've got Whispering Paul McDowell on vocals, so... His name is sort of separated out because essentially they're presenting this as being like a band with a step out vocalist rather than a singer with a band type thing.
Yeah.
They're sort of surreal. They dress period. They use like, you know, megaphone for vocals and that sort of stuff. It's all stuff that really does feed into a particular sense of a type of sense of humor, sort of bringing the surreal into the music sphere.
Hmm.
They're quite important in their own way. It's sort of postmodern, which is something that sort of builds through the 60s as people sort of look back and revisit and use old things to make new things type stuff.
Yeah.
And this is very different from everything else. It's a proper homegrown British hit for George Martin, his first number one that he oversaw.
Right.
Interesting. And it's very long as well for a single of the period. It's over 4 minutes.
It is long, isn't it? It does seem to go on for quite some time. But yeah,
it's trad jazz, mad trad jazz.
Yeah. So I wasn't expecting this time or any time. When it first started, I thought, this is like one of McCartney's kind of exuberances. And then remembered that not this time it isn't.
Nope.
Give him several more years and the freedom of studio recordings, but not, yeah.
And working with a producer who'd produce stuff like this.
This kind of thing, yeah. And that makes a lot of sense when you piece that together. But, and I was quite enjoying it as an instrumental ditty for the kind of minute and a half. And I was thinking, we've had two instrumentals back to back before that someone starts singing on it. And I thought, now we've got a kind of like a Tom Lehrer-esque type of comedy vocal. And I got that. But then it isn't a comedy vocal. And I don't find the half-spoken feel to it as my kind of thing. I kind of want the melody in the chorus. Mm-hmm. It's being sung a bit like a parody or
that's the postmodernism, the irony.
But they haven't changed the word, so it is just the original. Yeah, it's hard to listen to it ironically with my ears at this point in this stage of time. So it's
a tricky one because it's not that they're not going ha ha ha. Look at the 1920s, but they are saying we are deliberately, ironically using the styles of to make something new.
But then they're just redoing it, aren't they?
But there was a weird thing where trad jazz was like possibly going to be the sound of the 60s. People were saying, there's been a few artists doing this sort of thing. There's a film called It's Trad Dad that comes out around this time as well. And people making all sorts of proclamations. I think what's really interesting about this episode, particularly when you think about the type of Elvis stuff we've had, the sort of doo-wop stuff, it's such a weird mix, this episode, because the big players in the music industry are trying to make decisions about what's going to hit.
Yes.
So the thing is, all sorts of different things are hitting at this point.
Yeah.
So no one really knows how the 60s are going to play out.
It's very eclectic.
What's going to be the next big thing?
The people of the early 60s do not know what they want at this stage. Well, they kind of do in patches, but then the next thing that comes along is like, there's a couple of groupings of like, okay, there's a couple of croonery stuff there. But their tastes are obviously malleable, aren't they, at this point? And different ones are breaking through.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wonder if this is because this is also slightly pre the amalgamation of all the charts into one real kind of central type of, this was definitely what most people were listening to. I wonder if there's a bit of that.
Maybe, I don't know. Obviously, without all the different charts next to each other.
Certain outlets maybe had kind of more, I don't know. But anyway, back to this one. I find the singing speaking style a bit annoying, to be honest. And the music starts to get on my nerves a bit. I like a minute and a half of it being a jaunty kind of trad jazz. And it's all very proficient and slick in that kind of jazzy kind of way. You know, it just goes on altogether too long and everything's playing at once and there's too many counter melodies.
That's a feature of trad jazz is that you tend to have a lot of sections where it seems like everyone's doing their own thing.
Yeah.
And then you'll have some step out solos partway through, usually like a muted trumpet type thing.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Or
like they take a solo and then they come back and then they carry on doing their solo but quietly whilst the next person starts their solo and it's all very musical, musician-y. And then there's that weird section around 3 minutes in when they do a kind of an arpeggio thing and then the outro and there's not really any more singing apart from in a small bit in the middle, really.
Yeah,
I just find it strange that it's got to number one. I like how Macca uses this style in things like Honey Pie and all that. But it's always, for me, this is me personally, borders on the kind of twee and irritating. And it's a very delicate line. And for me, this one crosses that line too much because I don't know the irony and the context. So it just feels...
Well, one thing it isn't is, I mean, even if they, as a stage performance, I suspect if you saw them live, you would absolutely love them.
Yeah.
And it would be very interesting and very funny and very, like, quite an intense performance. The thing with the Bonzos is by the time the Bonzos are doing their trad jazz stuff on record, their stuff is funny. They've selected this material very well, and it's funny, and it's delivered in a more obviously funny way. The humour doesn't necessarily come across on record.
No, this
comes across on all their advertising materials and all the marketing and stuff like that that I looked up and saw. But if you don't get it, it's just someone covering a song from 1930.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'm giving it 37 for music.
I will say, if anyone wants to see Betty Boop, classic cartoon character Betty Boop doing it, she performs it in the short film Silly Scandals, which was pre-Hays Code, which was the censorship.
Right.
Self-censorship thing that the motion picture industry sort of put on itself. And so in Silly Scandals, if you want to see Betty Boop's dress fall down while she's singing this, carry on. But that's because that's what happens while some penguins dance behind her.
Blimey. Okay. Well, let's go on to production then. I can't say too much bad about the production, and I'm quite glad I didn't because
Big George.
You can hear all the little instruments playing their whatnots. The uke backing, is it uke?
Sort of banjolele.
The brushes on the drums and all that. It's just the arrangement choices, which isn't really going to be George's fault if he's just capturing a band that do what they do. But that the chaos of everything and the solos going on playing behind the next soloist, and it all just makes my head hurt. So there's something between music and production, I suppose, which could have helped with that. So I've given it 44 for production.
That's funny. I think it's very well recorded. The instruments are very distinct. You can tell that they are separate instruments, not
at
much.
The same time.
That's the style. Yeah. Apparently, it was a single take. So they come in to do some recording into probably Studio 2 or something like that in Abbey Road. And they play this as a warm-up while they're getting ready. And he's like, that's the one. Record it. They do it in one take. And it becomes a number one. Brilliant.
I
like his work.
We're talking about number ones here. It obviously had something, didn't it? So, and he heard it, and that's a good thing. But I'm still giving it 44 for production. So, lyrics then. Again, another traditional song where the people who were listening to perform it didn't write them, but, I'm judging the whole song as a whole thing. I like the rhymes that end in the same word but rhyme the preceding word, like flame deer, same deer, blame deer, I like that little device. And I like when one line starts with the rhyme of the last, such as hurt me, desert me. It's very much of the style. And obviously it is I'm presuming it's just the actual words from the original song anyway. But like I said, they're not spoof or comedy words. They really are just standard fare. So I've just given them 42 for lyrics and 41 overall. There's not much to say about them apart from those kind of...
Well, poor old George Martin. I hope he does better in another production. I wonder.
I'd have thought so. Not for me. One of those ones. But I can appreciate the musicianship and the skill
of
most of them, but the singer. So, finally... We have, it's that Elvis Presley again. Surrender.
All the stars will tell the story.
Surrender, Paul.
I feel like it at this point with Elvis.
I feel like giving up. I give up. Well, all right, Elvis, we surrender.
Okay, well, it's because I'm going to go, it's Surrender. It was based on a song from Europe.
Oh, right. Of course it was.
It's produced by Steve Sholes with Bill Porter Engineering at RCA. It's another huge hit. It spends 4 weeks at number one.
Yeah.
All this stuff. So composer is Ernesto de Curtis. But Doc Pomus and Mort Schumann are a songwriting team in America who write the English adaptation of it. Okay, because it's basically a song called Torna a Sorrento, or Come Back to Sorrento, as it's more well known in the English language of the version of the original. From 1894, they do this version, a bit like they did with O Sole Mio. They basically go to a Neapolitan song and do this. It's a number one in America as well. It's there's a B-side, a song called Lonely Man. It's just more of the same with Elvis. Like, it's just, they've just hit a formula.
Yeah.
And they're just doing it. I mean, this is the people who wrote it. Wrote it. I'm doing it in inverted commas. Pomus and Schumann. These are the guys who wrote A Teenager in Love, Save the Last Dance for Me, Sweets for My Sweet, Viva Las Vegas, and tons more songs you'd know.
Yeah.
You know, and but then this is a number one for 4 weeks in the UK, and I've never heard it.
Never heard of this one. No.
And when you think of Elvis, you don't think of this thing. I mean, it's quite nice and moody in a sort of minor key way, but flipping heck, just get on with it, Elvis.
Well, I mean, I this is one of my favourite Elvis ones so far that we've covered. Because
what?
Yeah, I think so. I think it might be. I'll have to see what the scores say in the end. But I agree in general. I mean, I'm only talking out of the ones that we've covered so far, seeing as we've missed all the good stuff, I think. But
more or less.
No, I'd never heard of this in my life. And it's so weird that something that can be part of... that someone so big like Elvis can be often so big that you kind of become a bit kind of blinkered to what he actually did. Because you just presume you just presume that you probably know everything he did because you've never had to go and seek it out because it's always been there. But no, never heard this. We've got that Bond-esque, dramatic, Latin-style, frantic rhythm.
Yeah.
Kind of being banged out throughout on the accompaniment with the drums rolling and the building and that frenzy until we hit the chorus and it's all in a minor key and then we hit a chorus and it goes into a soft little transition into a major key, doesn't it? And it goes all happy and cheesy and samba and other such European words that I'm probably getting wrong. But it's a very strange song, so I think that's what I like about it, its unusualness.
Well, we haven't had anything that's been sort of in the minor key particularly.
No.
Nothing we've done with him so far in this series has been with this feel.
This
minor key.
Yes.
Yeah, so.
And I think...
it's got a sort of push-pull type thing going on.
And because of that, I think this is the first time we really get... I've really heard within the songs that we've heard from Elvis a bit of the whatever the spark was that sparked the hysteria when he started wiggling his hips about and stuff, you know, doing his rock and roll. I can hear a bit of that in this. A bit of magic he's got in him.
I mean, his voice is brilliant.
Yeah.
In terms of his control of his voice, his ability to go soft and then strong.
Yeah.
What he doesn't do is get into his rock voice at all.
No, he doesn't get into his rock voice, but he's
got, gone that voice.
He's got some
for a while, anyway.
It's got an energy to it, which I can kind of see. Ah, I can see this kind of stirring people up more than Wooden Heart and his umpire band stuff. This is at least got a bit something about it. And it's a strange song in that it's a verse, a chorus, and then a bigger chorus, and that's it. And then it's done in under 2 minutes. We probably don't remember it or know it because we've just missed it. Because it's so short. I like it. I don't know what purpose it serves. I don't know if I'd dance to it. And if I did, would I have to have a rose between my lips and be flinging kind of my wife around in some kind of Mediterranean terrace? Would I have to do that because of the song? It's a very...
Well, you do now.
It's a very filmic song.
Although, ironically, not from one of his films.
Not from one of the films, but from the Bond intro to the big overblown backing and build. It's full of drama intensity and it's got fun and charm. And actually, and with a great performance from the band and Elvis, you know, really selling it. I like the little guitar riffs in the chorus, the chord changes that modulate the chorus and bring it back to a minor key and then back to major again, which is really weird. Where you'd expect a second verse, you just kind of get a, no, we're almost, no, we're not, it was going dark, no, we're going happy again. Of the ones we've heard to so far, it's my favourite Elvis one. But I couldn't whistle it back to you. Unless I'm listening to it, I don't know how it goes. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
It's
yeah.
like, I was trying to say to it, like...
But you hear Wooden Heart once and you remember
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's, I think this isn't memorable, but it's good in the moment, listening to it, without being an earworm, which can be good sometimes, not to have just be a good song because our simple... brains just go, oh, I recognise little melody. Yeah, I've given it 60 for music. I think this is an interesting and overlooked one.
I'm just bored of it, of this stuff by now.
Yeah, I mean,
of this general. Elvis does adaptations.
But, yes, production. At least this one doesn't have crackling mics on it. By contrast, this manages a huge dynamic and frequency range really well, actually. I'm not a massive fan of that backing vocal sound that seems too treacly that you get in places, but and trebly, treacly and trebly, trebly treacle. But it's kept in check by all the other little sounds going on. There's a little tapestry of percussive hits and things, which is kind of indicative of the style, isn't it, really? Lots of little.
Well, I think what's interesting about this in terms of production, the thing I think is most interesting is this was recorded on October the 30th, 1960, in a session running from, or the session for this bit of the, you know, this song runs from 10 till 1. So this is a sort of 3-hour block where they do this. They do 9 takes, but they use take 4 as the master. But the main, the broader session, the bigger session that this is part of is a gospel session. So one of Elvis's loves was gospel music, and he'd always wanted to do gospel recordings, and he was getting to do it at this point. But it's just funny to think of them doing all these gospel songs, and in the middle of it, it's like, we're going to do the next single now, Elvis. Okay. And it's suddenly this.
Yeah.
And it's just, that's what I find quite fascinating. And, you know, is it cynically, oh, it's someone saying, Elvis, can you just do the next single now? What are we doing? Oh, that next adaptation thing. Okay.
I don't know.
Can you put loads of reverb on it till it's annoying? Yeah, sure.
I think his voice and the production of this works well within the space given to him. I think it must have taken quite a combo of production and his talent to deliver a song like this and make it with such a wide range, a consistent sounding record, but with such a wide range within it, because it does do lots of building and stopping, and he brings his voice down and goes up again. So I've given it 64 for production.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine.
So lyrics then. I mean, there's a lot of fire today, isn't there? I think someone burning like a flame in the last song, and now we've got When We Kiss My Heart.
Oh yeah,
on
burning
fire.
Like a flame, dear.
Yeah.
I need some Pepto-Bismol.
Yes.
Or Andrew's liver salts.
But I think that goes along with the kind of the minor key and the drama of it, to kind of, and him saying things like, you know, my heart's on fire and desire and all things. That's what I mean by it starts to, not like that, but it starts to kind of ignite a bit of Elvis interest in me. Not like that. Just like I can feel a bit of, oh, Elvis, he's coming for me.
Oh no!
I don't know what I mean by that. It's just,
hope it was like 1970s Elvis. He'd never catch up to you.
Yeah, it's just a bit raunchy and less doe-eyed, isn't it? This is a bit more.
Yeah,
like,
I suppose so.
Yeah, that's
suppose
what I'm trying
so.
To say. And the lyrics,
but it's the lyrics are rubbish, though.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, they're.
Oh God, this is gonna score higher than so many things I like. I can't believe it.
They're fine Mills and Boone lyrics, basically, for a song that basically is the musical equivalent of a Mills and Boone cover. So I've given it 40 for lyrics, so 55 overall. So don't worry, it's not gone mad.
Okay, and Disc magazine, the British paper, 20th of May 1961, Surrender sets new record. By the beginning of this week, Elvis Presley's Surrender has set a fantastic new record for advance orders, more than 450,000, and there was a possibility that the 500,000 mark would be reached before its official release date tomorrow, Friday. The previous highest advance orders were 358,000 for Presley's last disc, Wooden Heart. He is soaring away at this
Absolutely,
point.
Absolutely, yeah, he's flying. I should also say, in case any fans of earlier series are wondering why there's not so many decimals in this series, is I am kind of rounding them up or down, so you don't have to be bored with points this and point that, but they are there. So.
Oh, the purity of the turf has been sullied.
So there we go. We are done for another week. So I'm going to do a top 20.
Well, the next couple of episodes are only 4 song ones.
Yes,
don't worry.
We've had a couple
slog.
A couple of long ones, haven't we, to get us keep it evened. But okay.
Carry on.
So I'm going to do a top 20 because there's only one song that didn't make it into the top 20. So I'll do all the 20. But that is Wooden Heart at number 22.
Ha, take that, Elvis.
Yeah. You've just named two bands, two performers, two acts in one sentence. Take that, Elvis. It's all right.
Yeah, I got it.
Brain's not working. It's too late. So
read the list.
Let's do the chart. Okay. At number 20, Adam Faith, Poor Me. At number 19, Please Don't Tease, Cliff Richards and the Shadows. At number 18, Tell Laura I Love Her, Ricky Valance. At number 17, The Temperance Seven, You're Driving Me Crazy. At number 16, Johnny Preston, Running Bear. At number 15, I Love You, Cliff Richards and the Shadows. At number 14, Jimmy Jones, Good Timing. At number 13, Three Steps to Heaven, Eddie Cochran. At number 12, Floyd Kramer, On the Rebound. At number 11, The Marcells, Blue Moon. At number 10, Starry Eyed, Michael Holiday. At number 9, Johnny Tillotson, Poetry in Motion. At number 8, Are You Lonesome Tonight, Elvis Presley. At number 7, It's Now or Never, Elvis Presley. At number 6, Surrender, Elvis Presley.
Oh!
At number 5, Walk Right Back, The Everly Brothers. At number 4, Kathy's Clown, The Everly Brothers. At number 3, Roy Orbison, Only the Lonely. At number 2, Shaking All Over, Johnny Kidd and the Pirates. And at number 1, it's still Apache.
Apache's really holding on there.
All the Elvis stuff is clinging together for company.
I can't wait till he's shoved right down the bottom of the charts.
The thing is, I said it last week and I'll say it again. I can hear what people hear in him. It's not my music, but it's hard to deny it's commercial.
Yep. I know.
His ability to sell literally anything, it seems.
Well, certainly for a little while longer, anyway.
Yes, there's still lots of time to go, and these ones at the top aren't at the top with very high scores, so I would expect this to change quite a lot for quite a lot of these songs, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So, there we go. So, we'll leave it to it, and we will see you next week. Thank you, bye.
And all the very best 60s to you too. Thank you.